I'm not going to reveal your age, but suffice to say that in certain European countries, you would now be facing mandatory retirement.
Exactly, exactly, yeah. And I've had quite a first week of a sort of retirement. I played Tuesday in Boston and Wednesday in New York and Thursday and Friday and Saturday in Philadelphia.
No rest for the wicked.
Well, it's the kind of week that you wouldn't turn down. I mean, it'd be a kind of a fantasy dream for a young student.
Indeed. It's now getting to the stage where because of better nutrition and better medicine that we're getting pianists such as yourself who will potentially be playing for years and years to come. And we're at the point where you are now significantly outliving the composers who are writing the music. Are you finding more in it because you're older than them? And is there anything else in there that you can find because you get to play for longer?
That's probably an unanswerable question. Just to context it, as they say, let's think about the fact that Schubert died when he was 31. And, you know, his last piano sonata is considered one of the most profound things ever written for the piano. And when I was told when I was a youngster that youngsters can't play this, you can't play this till you're old. And I remember thinking, but Schubert was 31 when he died. And so he certainly wrote it before he died. So I don't know. I mean, that presupposes that there is a right way or there's a canonic way or there's kind of an absolute way of playing it right or beautifully. There are several ways. I mean, there are many ways of doing it badly, obviously. But yeah.
Are you personally finding more things, more layers in works that you've played often than, let me say, the more you play them, or as you get older?
Yes, inevitably and organically. I don't try. It's related to the fact that I and probably most people don't play pieces the same way I did, you know, 42 years ago, for example, when I first played the Brahms D minor concerto. And the nerve I had, my first performance was with the Philadelphia Orchestra. My off-Broadway tryout didn't work. So there I was at Saratoga with this great orchestra. But yes, inevitably you do find things. You see, you know, also when you're young, your teachers say, oh, well, every time I come back to this piece, I see new things. And when you're young, you think, what is there to see?
It's just notes on a page.
Well, the notes on the page and actually the events are the same. But their relationships and the long-range planning, the sort of ability to see the end of the beginning or know exactly where you're going or pacing. Actually, pacing is the big thing which seems to get better with age, knowing where emotionally and musically things might lag or need to be pushed or vice versa. But yeah, I do see. Also, the other thing is that when I take a new piece, I see a lot more in it. You know, for example, a kid can bring me a sort of standard repertory piece in a master class and I can, you know, see stuff in it right away because I know that, oh, that's probably going to come back and this is how it's varied here. And this is the kind of stuff you know just by a lifetime of association. Yes, I do think I see layers. There are two sides to this question. There's, of course, the familiarity where things don't surprise you as much. And sometimes then there is the wonder and the awe of the fact that you are shocked and taken aback again by the music itself where it takes you totally out of yourself, even though you know it, you know, better than probably the composer ever knew it.
And are the life experiences that you've had, the sadnesses, the happiness, the things that there are more of them in a life the longer it goes on, are they coming out through the fingers?
Oh, that I have to let other people say. Ah. I don't really know the answer to that. But probably my first inclination is to say, of course, inevitably, because one has a broader range of experience and feelings. But I don't know directly how they come out any more than how Mozart could have written his most tragic string quartet the night of the birth, the uncomplicated and joyous birth of his first child. He went upstairs and penned the saddest quartet he ever wrote. So I don't think art functions that, you know, you have a bad day and you write an unhappy piece and you have a nice day and you write a happy piece, or that I as an interpreter have a wonderful day and therefore I play even better only if the piece is happy. I don't think there's any kind of direct correlation because, for example, one of my great teachers said that you can't create a fabulous performance. Let's call it miraculous performance. You can only create the conditions under which it might happen. I mean, let's say it's a piano recital. You can have a great hall, a great piano, a great public, a great pianist, and a great program, and the pianist has done everything just right and is in best possible form. That still doesn't mean it's going to happen. And sometimes it happens with all of those six things not being quite as good. So it's really very hard. There's no controlling. It's just like life itself. There's no controlling all the variables to say this will happen. In other words, perfection is not attainable. We do have to aim for it. But I think I got off on a tangent there.
No, not at all. No, it's very interesting.
But so I really don't know. I also remember hearing some great musicians when they were elderly, and some people, and I won't name which ones because they were very great musicians, but sometimes I felt the performance really sounded a little antique. You know, these were musicians who were very old and sounded antique and somehow to me not satisfactory for some of the works they were playing, and others found great spiritual enlightenment in it. So we're not going to agree about this either.
Well, do you know when to stop?
Probably not any longer. You're probably going to have to drag me off the stage. I like to think I'm, you know, I'm whatever age I am now, that famous retirement age, the old retirement age,
yeah.
The Medicare age. And I like to think that I'll be very responsible and know when I can't play things like the Brahms D minor or the Rachmaninoff third anymore, because, you know, I'm sure that by the time I'm 80, I won't be playing the Rock 3 anymore, even though I could probably play it still pretty well. There is a certain muscularity about certain virtuoso repertoire, which
particularly Rachmaninoff, because you could have exchanged clothes with him. I mean, you have the same physique as him, you have the same hand size as
him. Pretty much, although he was leaner than me. It's not only Rachmaninoff is a matter of size, but it's a matter of the stylistic difficulty. I mean, Chopin was, you know, less than half my size in poundage, and, you know, was a little, you know, tubercular weakling who also died very young, and he's very hard to play too. It's not just the sheer muscularity of things. So I hope, as I said, I hope I'll know when it's time to stop. On the other hand, I now begin to understand why some elderly musicians never want to retire, because there's just nothing like it. I mean, there is just nothing like the high of a really good performance. And I think all of us performers are adrenaline junkies anyway, that's for sure. And adrenaline, as any doctor will tell you, is a very powerful chemical, and it's really best when it's naturally manufactured. There's just nothing like it. So I'm very conscious of the fact that every time I have a good performance, and I hope that's most of them, it's like I just want to keep on doing this as long as I can. So as I said, you're probably going to have to drag me off the stage and say, you know, have people tell me that I'm an embarrassment to myself. But we'll wait and see. I don't know.
When we first met 10 years ago, I believe it was in Wilmington, Delaware, you said something to me that I still remember. And I remember going back and listening to the tape to see if I'd gotten it right. And you said that to be a successful concertizing musician, you needed three gifts. One, the gift of music. The second was look. Sometimes you had to be in the right place at the right time to get mm-hmm. the breaks that you needed to get. And a lot of musicians will give you those two. They'll say those two things do happen. And you said that you were also given the gift of the ability to practice and to focus. And you said that when you were a child, you could listen to your friends outside playing and you were quite happy to stay at the keyboard practicing. I'm holding it to your own words now,
well,
10
I
years after the
now,
fact.
Now, I'm not sure I would quote myself the same way. I mean, the story I usually tell is that when I was 9, my mother would have to force me to go out and play with the kids, because
right.
I'd rather stay in and play the piano, except that wasn't practicing. I mean, it's a cute story, but I wasn't focusing and practicing. I wasn't, you know, the equivalent of Mozart writing pieces. For me, it was playing. It was playing the piano in the playing sense rather than dedicated work. On the other hand, the ability to focus, the ability to be happy with yourself and working that way, I suppose that is luck. I mean, because, Matt, you know, I won't disagree with myself entirely, but the ability to focus and be happy focusing the way you need to may be a gift, and that may have something to do with luck rather than virtue, because the ability to sit there and concentrate, people, I mean, often say, you know, how virtuous musicians are. Well, we are, of course, I mean, but are we more virtuous than other people? I don't know. The fact is that I think you need the gift to be able to sit there and want to make it better and actually sit with yourself and finally internalize, after all your teachers are no longer teaching you, and that you have to be absolutely, you know, your teacher, or you have to conduct your little orchestra of 10 fingers. That is something that takes a lot of application, of course. But whether it's a sort of a penitential hair shirt virtue, I don't know. Because I get, unlike a conductor, I get actually to hear the results pretty quickly. I don't have to sort of plan it all out like a general planning a battle campaign and then sort of see if it works. I actually, you know, oop, that didn't work, and I can try it again, and I can actually, the practicing process isn't just practicing. It's actually dealing with really elevated music on a high level, and not every day of every practice session, hardly. But there are, in any good 3-hour practice sessions, there's probably, you know, 5 to 6 ecstatic minutes. If I don't know the Brahms First Concerto by now, I'd better give up. Sorry to be a little bit...
And you're never, there's naughty. No new ideas coming in your head. There's no, that occurred to me, I don't know, if you played it 3 times in a row and you say...
Oh, it does,
but
absolutely.
You'll change that on the fly.
Absolutely on the fly, yeah. No, I mean, I know the piece, as I say, it's so in my hard drive that it's not that I don't ever practice it, but what I was practicing right now had nothing to do. I find that if I practice... The day of a big concert, say with the Philadelphia Orchestra, if I practice the piece I'm going to play tonight, I only get more nervous and I get too many ideas and I actually get very specifically focused and I worry about that one passage and then I screw it up at the concert. Doesn't work for me at all. And similarly, when I was a student at Juilliard, I mean, I was probably Sasha Gorodetsky's favorite pupil and I mean, that's okay, I can live with that. But he was always talking about what a wonderful lesson I had to the other students. And they said, do you practice 14 hours before the day of a lesson? In fact, I said, no, I don't practice the day before a lesson. I don't cram ever. I can't cram. I'm not a crammer. It makes me panicky. I practice very well the day after and for the next 5 days, and then I take a day off.
And is it all then when you go onto the stage, it's all about muscle memory?
No, it's about, I know.
Does your body
there.
Know how to play it? Or are you humming it in your head? Or
no,
what's
no.
the process? Have you analyzed what the process is of recalling it is?
Yes, there's no simple answer to that one either. Yes, muscle memory is essential. Without that, you're sunk because you cannot – I mean, it's impossible to play the piano. I mean, for example, let me give you a concrete answer to that. If you play Chopin's First Etude, which many good pianists can do very well, you're playing 600 notes a minute. You can't mentate 600 thoughts a minute. So, sure, muscle memory is what saves you when you're nervous, when you're fearful, when your concentration goes. You learn, if you're worried about something, not to think too much because that only gets in the way. But no, it's much more the totality of the living organism of the Brahms First Concerto. And I'm listening to the music and hopefully I know it so well, and hopefully pianists who are good know it so well that you're actually on the other side of the mountain from the average person who's either a listener or even a young student who hasn't learned it. I mean, you've crossed the mountain and you can actually look back at the view. One of my distinguished colleagues, Martha Argerich, who plays piano better than anybody in the world probably, is rumored to have told, this is a story, but said that the reason she still practices so much is so that she can enjoy the experience while she's doing it. In other words, you have to be, Isaac Stern said always, you have to be 150% prepared in order to give 100%, because there's always a tremendous attrition. I mean, no matter what kind of phenomenal musician you are, you're never as good as the sum of your parts. You can't be all at once. And so that, no, what I can do with Brahms' D minor concerto now is listen to what happens in the orchestra and, you know, either then move or not move. I don't have to worry about, you know, where those notes are at all. It is a profound muscle memory, but it's much more. And it's an emotional relationship with all the moving parts of the piece and the whole, as I say, it becomes a living organism. So that, you know,
and it's reacting to individual musicians, not just to the 100 musicians who are
there. Absolutely. I mean, it depends on, you know, what that oboe solo does or, you know, you develop a sixth sense. I mean, you just know that, you know, you can actually hear in an orchestra just when, you know, that chord will come later, or you see the conductor's baton and he or she hasn't prepared well enough sometimes, or sometimes it's prepared so perfectly that there's 1,000 things that happen in every second.
And you're reacting to all of them,
yeah.
if you're on form or always?
Well, both. And sometimes you're reacting better than you are other times. It's uncontrollable once again. I don't mean to make this too mysterious or too easy, but it's
fascinatingly mysterious.
Yeah.
Do you understand the process?
No.
Even?
No, I don't. And we spent our whole life doing it, trying to understand. I mean, if you're a reflective person, you try to understand what you're doing. But ultimately, you can't understand too much. I mean, it was very... There's one of the, I mean, Maria Callas has a lot of great interviews, of course, and in one of them later on in her life, she was being asked by an interviewer, her famous take was, you know, no matter how dramatic she was and no matter what a great actress she was, first the music. You have to know the music so well that, in other words, you don't have to think about it. And she said, of course, you do have to think and you do have to use your brain, she said, but not too much, she said, with great emphasis. And I must say, I'm no Maria Callas, but I agree with her. Because you can't think your way to a great performance, and you can't think your way through a concert.
And if when it's good, it's flowing through you.
Absolutely. When it's good, it's almost disembodied. It's almost like, am I actually, you know, how do I know what note's coming next? That's also the danger of thinking too much. It's like sometimes it's going so well that, you know, you're sort of like, oh, my God, this is great. Well, don't even stay there too long because you might screw up.
Everything you hear on WRTI is made possible by members. Please join today.